Ms. McCarthy. Each side, again, we have 15 minutes. Ms. Butko, do you want to reserve any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
She'll reserve 3 minutes. Go ahead. For the appellant, Mr. Alford.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here on behalf of Brian Alford to discuss the legal issues in this case, and the true questions for this court is going to be the application of the felony murder rule. There are several jury instructions that were given in this case that are also problematic that I'd like to discuss. One of the problems in the case is that we know that Brandon and Brian Alford were involved in fist fights that were mutual. During these fist fights, the gun falls out and a gunshot occurs. We have no witness that testified that gun was pointed or aimed at Jerome Castro in any way. And in fact, the state's key witness, Crystal Hall, testified under oath that the gun was pointed up above the head and toward the wall, not pointed at Jerome Castro. That's critical, because the question in this case, the state charged their alternative theories, and I would submit to you that they did not prove willful, premeditated, deliberated murder with malice. Because you have an act of rage, you have an immediate setting, you have no intention to kill. Brian Alford, when immediately confronted by the police, says, the gun went off accidentally, I didn't mean to kill anybody. That's believable, because the gun is not pointed, there's not a witness who says any threats of I'm going to kill you. And when Brian Alford left, he thought that the victim was merely hurt. He thought he broke his jaw. He actually was bleeding on his own leg and thought the gun, when it went off, actually shot him and nobody else. Now, when you look at the case from the felony murder standpoint, we are using the burglary as the inherent crime to take away the state's obligation to prove malice. That's the Contreras case. And in the Contreras case, where I coincidentally represented Rocky Boyce on appeal, which was a co-defendant, this court held that burglary with the intent to commit battery could be an enumerated felony as far as the felony murder rule goes. However, this fact setting is very different. In the Contreras case, 9 people marched into a little apartment motel room and beat up the victim in that case with a stick. This particular case, there's mutual combat going on outside. It's on the landing. There's blood on the landing. The banister's broken. There's blood on the sidewalk and blood in the parking lot. None of that blood's tested, so we don't know whose it is, but we see evidence consistent with the fight occurring outside the residence moving into the residence. Once that happens, can that be a burglary to escalate this crime to first-degree murder? The Justice of the Peace didn't even find probable cause that a burglary occurred, yet the case went to trial on a first-degree theory. We would submit that that's wrong. The arguments of the district attorney during the closing argument were extremely confusing, and I think this court should look heavily at that. As you recall, my client was charged with the attempted robbery of victim Dudley, yet nothing was taken from Mr. Dudley. He arrived at the hospital with his wallet intact, his cell phone, and victim Castro arrived at the hospital with $350 cash in his pocket. There's no robbery going on here. Yet the district attorney in its closing argument argued the facts of the robbery and then said, oh, but he's not charged with felony murder based on robbery, but that wouldn't be sufficient. So we confused this jury between the argument and the jury instructions. When the jury was deliberating, the jury said specifically, sent a question out to the judge, if this is mutual combat going on and that mutual fight moves into the residence, is that burglary? Instead of doing as the defense suggested, and that is submitting instructions 26, 27, and 28, which covered the fact that the intent had to be formed before the entry into the residence happened, the judge sent only the burglary definition to the jury in the answer to that question. The district court judge acknowledged when he did that, that if he was wrong on this issue, he was basically giving the state a directed verdict on first-degree murder. I would submit to you that's what he did. That answer to the jury was improper. The next question was the jury instruction on adequate provocation. In this particular case, we know that Brian Alford was provoked. We know there was a fight. We know he was nothing to do with any of the events of the earlier part of the night where there was anger and hatred between Jerome Castro and his twin brother Brandon. He walks into that place expecting to pick up a couple of kids and leave. He doesn't go there expecting to kill anybody. He goes there with a gun expecting to defend himself because there were threats sent out that The folks that were at this mobile home were going to go shoot up the residence of Melissa Simcoe, even if her kids were there. And Melissa Simcoe's kids were in that mobile home. So they zoomed over to that mobile home to get those children out of there to safety, only to find out that when they went to leave, this fight's going on. The jury was not allowed to hear that Brandon Alford was convicted of battery with a deadly weapon in this case, not a robbery. And so it's interesting that the state was allowed to use all of the night's events against Brian Alford. That would be the use of the ecstasy, the threatened three-way sex allegation, the threatened date rape allegation, and basically portray this nightmarish situation to the jury. But the defense wasn't even allowed to say, hey, Brandon Alford was convicted of a battery deadly weapon. Nothing more serious.
But Ms. Butko, isn't our law generally, it's up to the judge's discretion as to what evidence would be submitted to the jury, and we don't reverse that judge's decision unless there's an abuse of that discretion. Tell me why you feel it was an abuse of the discretion not to allow the evidence regarding the other Mr. Alford, you know, and that you described here.
What we did was we did not portray this fascinating accurately to the jury, because we allowed this jury to hear all this damaging evidence against witness Brandon Alford and witness Melissa Simcoe, who were called by the defense counsel on the case. And the court did that based under the res geste doctrine, which was completely improper, because you could portray and start this murder at the point in time where my client goes to get a gun in the Northwest. And you could simply have this jury pondering over there was an argument between Jerome Castro and Brandon Alford, which caused a fight.
So this res geste doctrine, which is a Latin term, means that the judge let it in so the jury would hear the whole story of what happened there. That was the judge's reason. Normally it may not come in, but for the jury to understand what the whole situation was, he let this other evidence in. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that was a complete abuse on his part, because that evidence was so damaging and overly prejudicial. The question becomes, was it more prejudicial than probative? And in this case, you're accusing people of use of illicit drugs, purchasing illicit drugs, forcing others to take illicit drugs, three-way sex allegations. I ran this case by one of my friends and her eyes bugged out of her head. Now picture the jury. She's a lawyer. That was so prejudicial and so harmful to the defense. Yet when the defense says, we want the jury to know that Brandon Alford wasn't convicted of a robbery, and my client's on trial for the attempted robbery of Laura Dudley, Brandon Alford, who did the same things, wasn't even charged, we were not allowed to bring that up. The other key, I think there's several other keys to this case, and that is Detective Jenkins. Detective Jenkins pulled a fast one and violated our Constitution, and I'd stand by that. Detective Jenkins knew on the street corner in Northwest Reno where my client was arrested that my client wanted to talk to his girlfriend, Tarina. He asked, can I speak to her? She asked, can I speak to her before you take him away? He says, oh, no, not here on the street corner. That won't work. It's not safe. Come on down to the police department. We'll let you talk to him, sure. So she does. And they set her and my client in a nice little interview room with no signs and nothing that says, hey, by the way, you're being recorded or audiotaped or videotaped.
But aren't the police entitled to trick criminal suspects, lie to them, do whatever they can to get them to confess as just part of their investigation techniques? Don't they do that all the time? Isn't that permitted?
No, there's a fine line that they crossed here. It is permitted to trick a defendant into saying something or to say they have other witnesses that refute that and they don't have any witnesses. That's permissible. In this case, what they did was they violated Nevada law, statutory law, and constitutional law. When they put Tarina Weatherhead in that little room, they actually used her as an agent of the police. Detective Jenkins said, I was doing that to get evidence. It's amazing what you can glean from the defendant's conversations. So he intended to get my client's statements without advising him of his Miranda rights, without protecting
him. Was your client in custody at that time?
He was absolutely in custody. He was in handcuffs and arrested on the scene in Northwest Reno.
Now, and no time before that, was he advised of his rights?
No, he was not. Detective Palmer interviewed him and did not advise him of his Miranda rights.
So my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, if somebody's a suspect in a case, They can be questioned without being advised of their Miranda rights, being the right to remain silent and the right to request an attorney. But the moment they're placed in custody, they cannot be questioned unless they're read their Miranda rights, or you cannot use those statements against them. So you're saying that if he was in custody and they put him in this room through a trick, even though he wasn't questioned, but they were listening in, that that's a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Is that correct?
That's my position. Okay. And I disagree with the respondent who said that's just good old-fashioned police work. That's a violation of our Constitution. It's an intentional backdoor to try to get around the fact that they would have been required to tell my client what his rights were before they interviewed him.
Yes. I'm not sure I'm following the use of the girlfriend as an agent of the police. I mean, I get the whole setup thing and that they're listening, but how do you tie that together?
Well, normally when the police use someone as an agent, it's like they send in somebody into the jail, into that cell, and they really treat the defendant covertly. But in this particular setting, they didn't tell Tarina Weatherhead she was being recorded or audio taped. They didn't tell my client. The room even had the equipment.
Do they have an obligation to tell her that she's being recorded?
Oh, I think so. She's a private citizen. She doesn't have the... I mean, I think they have to tell them. Interesting issue. I didn't brief that because I'm not her attorney.
Well, we know if they're on the telephone, you can't record somebody's telephone conversations without a wiretap order from a court. So if one person's speaking on the phone in Nevada, you cannot record the other person's... cannot tape record this person. That's illegal. But my understanding was that's only a special rule for telephones. But like if you're in this room and somebody slipped a tape recorder under one of the students' chairs and two students were talking and they taped it and then somebody made incriminating statements, that they could use that tape against the student that was talking.
The question becomes your interpretation of electronic device. And in today's world, electronic device is getting wider and wider. We have iPods, iPads, Google phones, Blackberries, texting. This is an area of law you're going to see expand.
Yeah, Ms. Buckley, let me ask you this, and perhaps Justice Curry, give you a little more time, because I'm going to use an example of a case I had as a judge that reminds me of this factually. I had a case as a judge where a man was accused of dating women, and what he'd do is take them to a drive-in and give them sleeping pills and lemon Slurpees, and he'd take them back to his apartment, and they'd be asleep, and he'd film himself having sex with them while they were asleep, you know, like that. And then one of the women woke up once and then called the police, and the police came out to questioned how he took him into custody, but they told him the woman was dying. She was at the hospital. They had to know how much sleeping pills that he gave her so they'd know how to treat her. It turned out she wasn't dying. She was fine, but they lied to him, and he confessed that he gave her the sleeping pills and all, and he was convicted, and I was the judge on it, and all. So it's something I went through. Would you consider it somewhat similar to these kind of tricks? Is it proper to do stuff like that here?
Somewhat similar. It's proper, but the U.S. Supreme Court has drawn lines on cases where you can outright lie, but you can't manipulate the way that Detective Jenkins did on this case. He put two people together in a police custodial setting, one of whom was in a custodial setting, arrested, and he did it on purpose. I think he went beyond any right to cheat and lie.
Was there a motion to suppress?
There was no motion filed by counsel. So we're at a plain error standard.
Let me urge that again. Let me ask that question again so the students hear. Was there a motion to suppress the statement?
There was not a motion to suppress filed by trial counsel.
And you were not that attorney.
So you inherited
the case in the state it's in right now. But generally, I know Mr. McCarthy is going to argue that you may have a good argument on this motion to suppress, but if they didn't file that in district court to challenge the admissibility of that testimony, that you can't argue about it in front of the Supreme Court for the first time. What would your response to that be?
My response to that is if it's constitutional error and it's plain error affecting the substantial rights of my client, this court has a right at this stage to review that issue.
But generally, if you don't raise an argument before the trial court and you think of it later, you can't argue it for the first time in front of the Supreme Court. That's the general rule of law.
That is the general rule, and it's harsh for appellate attorneys.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve some time. Thank you.
Sure. I'll give you a couple extra minutes, too. Mr. McCarthy for the State of Nevada and the Washoe District Attorney's Office.
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. On the subject of the confession, I would first point out it's not actually a confession. He made some incriminating statements to his girlfriend, and they were, in fact, recorded. There was no motion to suppress. cannot be considered as plain error because the proposition of law now being advanced has never been recognized by any court yet. And if the law doesn't exist, it can't be plain error to not anticipate the law.
Minister McCarthy, isn't that kind of a dirty trick? I mean, he goes and demands being investigated. He thinks he's talking privately to his girlfriend in the room about the case, and the police are listening in and recording it. That sounds like kind of a nasty trick, but does the law let you do things like that?
Well, it does indeed allow things like that. I would point out that it was the defendant, the suspect, who said, please let me talk to my girlfriend. The girlfriend who said, please let me talk to my fella. This is not the cops out rounding up people to interrogate their suspects.
Well, defense attorneys call it a dirty trick, but the prosecutors call it felony stupid. Am I right?
Well, you know, it might be felony stupid. If I were sitting in a police interrogation room knowing I'm surrounded by cops, I don't know if I'd want to be making statements to my girlfriend.
We want the students to hear that. Say it once again for them.
Educational moment.
Yes.
If I were sitting in the police interrogation room, I don't think I'd want to make incriminating statements.
To anyone.
Fortunately, however, many criminal suspects are really stupid, including this fellow. He did so. Those statements were recorded, and they were used against him, and it was quite lawful for the judge to allow that. Had there been a motion to suppress, we might have explored a little bit more what the detective told the girlfriend beforehand, but there was no motion, so we really don't know.
And why isn't it plain error then?
Well, for two reasons. One, we don't know what was said to the girlfriend. Sometimes when police send an agent in to talk to a suspect in the jail or someplace like that, the agent will try to be nice to the fellow in jail and try to elicit a confession and then use them. But the question is not what the cop wanted, the cop who sent that agent. The question is what the agent thought. Did the girlfriend think she was working for the cops when she went and talked to her boyfriend? We don't know that because there has never been a hearing. It's never been explored. I would point out to the court that the other half of my job, besides being here, involves dealing with ineffective assistance of counsel. Whether there should have been a motion, I imagine we will address at some point, but not today.
Right. Ms. McCarthy, let me ask you this about in this case, Mr. Alford was convicted of first-degree murder. And, you know, usually when I saw these first-degree murder cases, you intend to kill somebody. You plan it, and maybe you sneak and shoot them and hide and waiting and all. But this one here, the weapon went off. It doesn't appear there was evidence for normal first-degree premeditation conviction here, but we have something called the felony murder rule and burglary. How is there a burglary in this case, and how does that make it first-degree murder?
I would, first, I think the evidence is sufficient to sustain the judgment on either theory, despite the possibility of that it was unintentional. There is other evidence, including threats to other people, you know, like asking, you want to be next, or something like that. But on the subject of the felony murder rule, our law, passed by our state legislature, allows for treating someone as a murderer, giving them a murder sentence, if someone dies, even by accident, during the course of certain kinds of felonies. Not every felony. Burglary is one of those felonies. Our legislature has also defined what is burglary. They have said that entry into a home or stores and other places, while having a certain larcenous intent, an intent to commit a crime, is a burglary. So if you enter a home with the intent to commit a crime inside the home, and someone dies during the course of that crime, that is first-degree murder.
So, for example, let's say somebody down the street at Walmart in Fallon, if somebody went in to steal a pack of chewing gum, let's say they had a gun in their pocket, and the gun accidentally discharged and a bullet hit somebody and killed them, they could be prosecuted for first-degree murder. Is that right?
That is correct. The classic example is the bank guard dies of a heart attack during the bank robbery. Mm-hmm. No one intended for that bank guard to die, and yet most states, including us, would allow the prosecution for murder because of that, if they could show a causal connection between the robbery and the death.
So your position is, even though maybe there's a disagreement, if there was sufficient evidence to show there was a premeditated murder, the jury concluded it was a first-degree murder, whether they arrived at that conclusion on the theory of premeditation or felony murder through a burglary, and that's sufficient then?
It is. The evidence is sufficient to sustain either theory. It's the state's contention.
I was going to ask you about that. What is the evidence of, like, premeditation, willful, knowing?
Picking up a gun on the way to the crime is pretty good evidence that one intends to use that gun. There was antagonism between these parties, and despite the contention that the gun fell out of the holster, there was other evidence of people that were present that disputed that. So this fellow pulled his pistol and shot this man in the head. What makes it unusual is that he didn't die from the bullet puncturing his head. He died from the concussive force of the bullet hitting his head, which would be rather akin to being hit in the head with a ball bat, I would think.
And premeditation can be formed in the blink of an eye, is that correct?
Well, we try not to use that instruction anymore, the successive thoughts of the mind. But if one thinks about it before killing, yes, that can be a premeditated murder. I have always suggested it takes three thoughts. When the defendant thinks to himself, I'm going to kill this fella, and then says, no, that would be a bad thing. I don't think I will, and then says, I'm going to do it anyway, that becomes a premeditated murder.
And when you have alternate theories like this, a felony murder and premeditated murder, the jury doesn't have to be unanimous on either theory as long as 12 of them feel that it's murder in the first degree.
That is the well-established law of this country. Not every country has that same rule, but our Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has ruled on that, and this court has also followed that rule.
And Mr. McCarthy, as you can see, some of our questions are designed to offer some information, if not education. But I want to go back just to how quickly the intent that gets you up to first degree can be established. Could, in this case, the gentleman have come to the mobile home for sole purpose of recovering the children, but upon other things happening in the 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes that he was present, could he have formed the requisite intent to take him up to first-degree murder?
Certainly in those few minutes. It becomes problematic where there is much less time, where the time involved is merely the time to pull the pistol and fire. This court has indicated that we should instruct the jury that premeditation, deliberation, especially deliberation, should require some reflection, some ability to think about it, to change your mind. I don't think there was any issues about those instructions in this case. I certainly hope not.
Now, Mr. McCarthy, let me ask you this. We have the three judges up here, and we've done a lot of cases and all. What if we went back and we've read all this record, and we just don't think the jury was right on finding first-degree murder? Can we do that, or what approach should we take to review this record to make our decision?
There are some courts in this country that have the authority to substitute their own judgment for that of the jury. This court is not among them. I once worked for an Ohio Court of Appeals that has such a rule. It was rather an odd rule. But this court has no such rule. The question is whether the evidence is sufficient. That is, you should examine the entire record and see if there is something supporting each element of the crime. Now, the court's aware that every crime, including murder, is divided up into parts, elements. So if there is any evidence supporting each one of those elements, then this court should say the jury could have believed that bit of evidence and could have disbelieved the other parts and therefore find the evidence is sufficient. This court should not act as the 13th, 14th, and 15th jurors.
Okay. What about the bad acts? I know that the appellant, Mr. Brian Alford, was really not involved in any of those acts. What's your take on that as far as whether it's error or not to allow that evidence before the jury?
Well, because he was not involved, it certainly couldn't have hurt him. There is no inferences to be drawn about this appellant's character based on what happened between his brother and the friends the evening before. I think the judge was an appropriate ruling to allow that evidence to come in.
And what is the legal theory that allows evidence like that?
Well, to allow the jury to understand what was happening. Why are these men, these armed men, standing in the living room of this home in Sun Valley, and why is there this incoherent woman who can't care for herself? What is everyone so angry about? If the jury didn't know those things, this case would make no sense to them. They said, who are these people? What is their relationship? This trial reads like a Russian novel with too many characters, and all of them have multiple names, it seems like. The one that stood out to me was a fellow named Country.
So the state's position is that Judge Flanagan did not abuse his discretion by allowing this other evidence in on these issues with the defendant's brother and others because it was to tell the whole story of what happened?
That's correct. And thank you for summarizing my arguments so well.
I agree with you, but I'll just, for the purpose of the students here, we'll try and clarify that.
No, that is my position, that the judge was correct in allowing the jury to hear the story of what happened in the evening before this homicide, so that the jury could understand who are these players and what are they doing there in this home this morning.
The defense attorney is free to argue to the jury both in the opening statement and in the closing argument that the defense attorney makes that, hey, my client wasn't there. You can't hold this against my client. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and I believe that happened in this case, although my memory has failed me from time to time. For the benefit of the audience, I would point out that I have three teenage children myself, and because of that, my memory fails from time to time.
Wait till you get to be my age.
did Brian Alford have to testify in this case, or how does that work?
He did not have to testify. A criminal defendant accused of a crime is never required to take the stand and give his side of the story.
And that is, of course, because of the presumption of innocence.
Well, not exactly. I think it is the presumption of innocence, I believe, refers to the prosecutor's burden of proof. Is instead a product of the Fifth Amendment right to never be compelled to present evidence against yourself.
I guess my inartfully phrased comment had to do with the fact that it's your job at trial. The defendant never has to get up off of his chair to prove anything, that it is in fact your obligation. He is cloaked with the presumption of innocence.
I agree with that entirely and wouldn't have it any other way.
Okay. Well, that's the U.S. Constitution and the Nevada Constitution. Ms. Butko made an argument about the burglary and the whole sequence of events, and apparently there was some sort of confrontation out in the yard or whatever, and then they went back in. The state should have to prove burglary as a separate crime in order to be able to invoke the felony murder rule on it. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, there are two issues that come to mind based on that. One of them is the suggestion that the fight started outside. That is supported only by the testimony of this appellant. Everyone else said that when Jerome Castro opened the door, this defendant spit in his face and punched him through the door and rushed into the house.
Okay.
There was no fight outside, but because he's throwing punches, the jury may infer he intended, when he entered, to do battle. That would make that a burglary. The other issue that comes to mind is the Justice of the Peace did not have this appellant stand trial on burglary as a separate charge. This court has already ruled on that subject and has not required that the predicate felony for a felony murder charge be separately charged. So, and that brings to mind the argument of the prosecutor who said nothing wrong. He said there is an attempted murder charge. That is not part of the felony murder. That was absolutely correct. I don't think we should chastise prosecutors for telling the jurors, don't do the wrong thing. My red light is blinking, and I'm out of time. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy, for your argument. Ms. Becko, I'm going to give you 3 minutes in rebuttal, please.
Thank you. We'll start with the last first. I would disagree with the recitation of facts, as a key witness, Melissa Simcoe, testified that after Brian Alford spit on Jerome Castro threw two punches at Brian Alford. And those happened in the doorway on the landing. The fight fell into the house. And I think the jurors agreed with me, because the key question from the jury was, if the fight is on the landing and moves into the house mutually, they're all fighting together, is it burglary? So I think that leads us to understand where the jury was. As far as the bad act evidence, it was just too much. It wasn't just evidence of a minor event. I mean, you're talking evidence of ecstasy use, wanting to get someone drunk and high on ecstasy so you can do a three-way date rape setting. That's just too much. That's too many black guys for my defendant who wasn't there to have to defend.
Were there any Petruccelli hearings held in this case?
There were, and Judge Flanagan ruled that he thought it was not more prejudicial than probative, but his basic ruling was the res geste doctrine allows it.
Okay.
As far as the Mulaney Doctrine, which I didn't argue on the onset, which I should have argued, the Mulaney Doctrine obviously holds the state to prove the absence of the heat of passion beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury was not instructed on the Mulaney Doctrine. That's U.S. Supreme Court authority. Should have been instructed on
it. Was it offered?
No. The other thing is, I agree with you. This is certainly not a premeditated, willful, deliberate murder. It's either felony murder, or it's manslaughter, or it's second degree. But it's certainly not traditional, classic first-degree murder. And where we're going nationwide is to get rid of this felony murder rule, because it makes every murderer a first-degree murder. And not every murder is a first-degree murder. So states like Alaska, Hawaii, Kentucky have abolished the felony murder rule. Other states are limiting it. And our state directly has said, in the year 2000, we are in favor of limiting the application of the felony murder rule.
Isn't that up to the legislature as opposed to the judges to do that?
Well, in this case, you're being asked to expand a mutual fight setting into intentional burglary, entering with the intent to commit battery at the time of the entry, when a person is defending themselves from the fist fight. He didn't enter there with the intent to kill anybody. I think that's pretty clear. And all of a sudden, the gun goes off, and one shot really did it. It's a terrible setting. The other thing I wanted to make sure I commented on was the Ney case, which specifically says that intent to commit that crime under the felony murder rule must occur before the entry into the residence. And I would submit to you it did not.
Well, I thought the alleged burglary or conviction for murder, because the jury must have concluded or appears to have concluded there was a burglary, that happened before the shot was fired, didn't it? Sequencing?
Well, I think the jury was misinstructed on that question, because they were instructed to only review the burglary instruction and not to review the fact that the state had to prove that intent on the time of entry. And that was Mr. Springate's key issue on his motion for a new trial.
Right. Now, and just to clarify the Ney case, I believe Justice Cherry wrote that decision, and that said that it, under the felony murder doctrine, where you have a robbery felony, let's say somebody goes into a liquor store and shoots somebody intending to rob it, then it would apply. But if you went in with the intent to shoot somebody and not to rob, but you robbed them like you took their money after the shooting occurred and they were killed, that you can't use the felony murder rule there. It has to predate, the robbery has to predate the actual shooting. And so you're saying that rule applies in this case as far as the burglary.
I believe it does.
Okay. Any further questions? Justice Sadie, just give it.
No.
Buckle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both attorneys for their excellent arguments, as I knew you would both do for these students, and your briefs also. So students, can we give